From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was President Trump's tweet that got the writer Mark Bowden thinking about North Korea. Bowden is a correspondent for The Atlantic. He wrote Black Hawk Down, among many other books. The tweet was about how North Korea has been testing nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, and it's gotten observers wondering about the threat to the U.S. Here's the tweet: "It won't happen." And maybe it won't, but Bowden says sooner or later the president is going to have to confront a harsh truth. There are no good options for dealing with that country. Bowden is joining us today to go through all these crummy options and talk about what we're supposed to do about North Korea. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. North Korea is a rigid, secretive, isolated dictatorship propped up by a racist mythology and a deep sense of paranoia. The journalist Mark Bowden says the country is built almost entirely on the promise of standing up to powerful enemies like the U.S. So over the years, they've been testing and moving missiles and nuclear weapons. In the cover article for The Atlantic magazine, Bowden says analysts are predicting Kim Jong-un will have the capability to launch a nuclear-tipped ballistic missile that could hit the shores of the U.S. before Donald Trump completes his first term in office. Over the years, American presidents have tried everything they could think of to contain North Korea's nuclear ambitions. They've tried threats and sanctions and military exercises, sabotage and diplomacy. Nothing has worked. And Bowden says in his article, maybe nothing ever will. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about his article. It's called The Worst Problem on Earth.
Well, the essence of the threat is that North Korea has successfully exploded 5 nuclear bombs, and they're building a bomb that's small enough to go on top of a missile, and they're also building ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles. And if they succeed in doing this, and most analysts think they could do it within 4 or 5 years, Kim Jong-un would have the capability of launching a nuclear-tipped missile on an American city. 30 minutes is the time it would take to get to a West Coast city. You know, Los Angeles is a nice fat target on the West Coast. So that's the, you know, bottom line, that's the fear that our country has for its own national security. Of course, North Korea has been a huge threat to the region and to South Korea for many, many years.
You write later in the piece that Americans have lived with a far, far greater threat for almost half a century, that the threat of nuclear attack is just something that Americans in some ways have come to just accept over time. And I'm wondering if you think that, how does that apply to the way we're thinking about North Korea as citizens, but also as an, you know, as an American government and administration?
Well, I think it's useful, you know, to remind Americans, and there are enough who are young enough that they really don't have any clear memory of the Cold War, but I do. I grew up, you know, in a world where the United States and the Soviet Union had thousands of nuclear-tipped missiles pointed at each other. And, excuse me, I can remember that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, there was fairly wide speculation that, you know, it would be only 20 minutes from launch to what would essentially have been the destruction of the Northern Hemisphere. So, I mean, that it sounds ridiculous to talk about it in that way, but that's exactly what the situation was. I think that since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the threat of an all-out nuclear exchange has receded, even though potentially, you know, there are still lots of nuclear weapons in Russia and various other countries and in the United States. I think even the Union of Concerned Scientists have turned back the minute hand on their clock till doomsday. So in that environment, the idea that a rogue regime like North Korea's would possess a nuclear weapon, I think rightly instills a tremendous amount of fear. But I think it's useful to remind people that it's not anywhere near the scale that we've lived through in the past.
You do mention that if North Korea had an operational nuclear weapons program, it could be the biggest threat in the world if you take into account the kind of volatile nature of their leadership.
Well, it is, you know, a government that has anticipated or been predicting an American invasion ever since 1953. They don't even consider the Korean War to have ended. Right. And their entire sort of raison d'etre is to build an arsenal that will deter South Korea and the United States from that invasion. And they've been successful enough at it that they have a very powerful military. They have chemical and biological weapons that could kill millions of people. They've exploded 5 nuclear bombs, and they're getting ever closer to being able to build a delivery system that could carry a nuclear weapon halfway across the world. So it's been a huge priority for the United States government to try to prevent North Korea from fully developing this capability. But so far, those efforts have not borne fruit.
Yeah. There was a conversation that I was listening to several weeks ago now on the public radio program On the Media, and they were interviewing the professor of international relations at the University of Southern California, a guy by the name of David Kang, studies North Korea. And he called North Korea an extremely rational actor who manages international politics and domestic politics with extreme precision. You say in your piece also that Kim Jong-un seems neither suicidal nor crazy. So just respond to that idea. Is the regime a rational actor in your mind?
Yes, I think they are. I think at the moment they're a more predictable country than the United States, to be honest. And, there's a tendency to think of Kim Jong-un as being crazy because the regime seems so crazy to us. I mean, the idea that you would have the divinely appointed tyrant who is, you know, descended from a line of divinely appointed tyrants whose every whim governs the lives of millions and millions of people, it strikes us as truly bizarre in this day and age. But given that that system exists, Kim Jong-un is the embodiment of it. He is precisely the person you would expect to emerge as the heir in that kind of a system. And since he's taken power, since the death of his father, Kim Jong-il, he's acted exactly the way you would expect someone like him to act, which is to consolidate his power, mm-hmm. to isolate and destroy his enemies, to issue threats and to respond when North Korea objects to movements that the United States or South Korea make. So I do think, as strange a regime as it is, it's very predictable and even methodical. Hmm.
So we know that the president has reacted to North Korea generally, or the potential threat of a missile strike, for example. We know that he's reacted via a tweet where he said basically this: "It won't happen." But I'm never sure how much a tweet actually represents the thinking of the administration or the people actually tasked with the job of worrying about this. It is the administration, I guess, from your perspective, reporting in this story, properly concerned?
Sure it is. And I think Trump's boasting that he won't allow this to happen are the things that actually prompted this story, because it raises the question, well, if we wanted to stop them, if we were determined to stop them, what could we do to stop them? And that was really the question that motivated writing this story. And what I did was seek out people who have had to wrestle with the reality of some kind of military action against North Korea to find out how they think about it and to basically sketch out 4 broad strategic options, all of which are really bad.
Yeah, really bad. We're going to break those down, Mark, as we go. But you mentioned in the piece that Trump's bluster, you know, expressed in those tweets, for example, just plays into kind of a role that North Koreans have in mind for American leaders and maybe Americans in general. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. And in that sense, are tweets like that just kind of unwise under the circumstances?
I think they're very unwise. And I do think that Trump, I think inadvertently, is playing right into the narrative of the North Korean regime. I mean, this is a country that has sort of created its own mythology. And a big part of that is that they are in danger of being invaded by the United States at any moment. I think most presidents have done their best to sort of tone down the rhetoric where that's concerned, because it really does play into the regime's efforts to build up the threat. And if they can build up the threat, they can rally their people to their own national defense. If you have a president who is boasting that he's going to prevent North Korea from acting in what it sees as its best interests, he might as well be threatening war. And that's exactly what they, you know, how they portray the United States. I do think that someone like Barack Obama was more difficult to portray as a belligerent American leader. Donald Trump doesn't seem to be aware that he's playing that role.
The Trump administration, as you report, has leaked plans for a decapitation strike to go strategically after Kim Jong-un. What do you make of that? And how do you explain the fact that they leaked something like this? I mean, what is the point of that?
I don't know, Doug. To me, and as I said in the story, it would seem to be the very last thing that you would ever like to advertise in advance.
Yeah.
I guess it's because they put a lot of, or Trump in particular, puts a lot of strength behind bluster, that you can intimidate people. I think it's a fairly foolish idea that you could intimidate North Korea. But as I said, I think it's part of a whole series of intemperate comments that he's made. And, you know, to me, the leaks are part of the whole approach that this administration seems to be taking.
I can't tell if you think if there is some kind of, you know, you have on one hand saber rattling, which is generally part of a strategy for geopolitics. And on the other hand, you have diplomacy. Is this kind of talk at least justified in the saber rattling part, as far as you can tell?
Well, I think the only way, Doug, that it might be is if somehow China were persuaded that the United States was just crazy enough to actually attack North Korea. Because the only hope that we have of putting significant pressure on Kim is China. And China has been, in the past, fairly reluctant for a number of reasons. One is, I don't really think it necessarily is terribly against their interests to have a regime in North Korea that's creating trouble for Washington and for Seoul. And another thing is, you know, they're dealing already with a fairly significant refugee problem, with North Koreans coming over the border into China, fleeing a very oppressive regime. And I think that, you know, they have an interest in trying to keep that from getting worse. So the only, and it's a stretch, the only way that I can imagine it might work to our benefit is to somehow make China feel like it has to do something more than they've done.
You write in the piece that the kind of the myth that fuels North Korea is that, it, you say, is built entirely on the promise of standing up to a powerful enemy. So does that mean that they don't see themselves as an offensive, aggressive force, but as just a very powerful defensive force?
Yes and no. I think they are not likely to invade China or Japan or launch, you know, military expeditions off of the peninsula. But they have definite designs on South Korea, yeah. And they still see Korea as a single country, a single entity that should be ruled by the Kim dynasty. And, you know, they have invaded South Korea in the past. They did it in 1951, very successfully, I might add, until the United States drove them out. So I think, you know, that is also a big part of the mythology, is to reunite the two Koreas under Kim's rule.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about the way North Koreans see South Koreans. It's 'cause it seems like in some ways the water has been kind of poisoned. I mean, isn't part of their myth the idea that South Koreans aren't really kinsmen anymore, but, have, you know, they betrayed them. They have become enslaved by the U.S. in some way.
Well, yeah, I think to some extent, but they would probably reserve that label of traitor for those who play an active role in the government of South Korea, or maybe, you know, industrialists who have profited, and many have in South Korea. But I think that, you know, the sort of the base of the myth of North Korea is that the Koreans are the purest, cleanest race. It's essentially a racist mythology. And, you know, they may be displeased with their southern cousins, but they definitely belong to the same race. And I think they, you know, they have designs, and I'm not just making this up. This is part of their announced long-term strategy, is to reunite all of Korea under Kim's rule.
Mark, you describe in your piece President Trump as being, you know, mostly ignorant of the long history between the U.S. and North Korea. But you do say at least he brings some fresh eyes to it. Talk a little bit about what you mean. Are you referring to has the U.S. become kind of stuck in some dated Cold War thinking about the relationship, that we lack a kind of creativity when we're thinking about relations with North Korea?
I think you always have to leave open that possibility. I mean, the United States diplomatic and military efforts in that part of the world haven't been very successful over the last 30 or 40 years. And in particular, President Obama's strategy of what was called strategic patience was notably ineffective. So I don't know myself of an alternative to the way the United States has approached this problem. And I sought out people who have been wrestling with it for a long time, and they don't have any idea either. But I think, in fairness, a new administration, new people, a new president, you know, maybe he can come up with something startlingly different that'll have that'll make a difference. I just can't imagine what that would be.
You've written about all of the attempts over the last 50 years to deal with this issue, most of them being pretty futile. We tried threats, we tried military exercises and sanctions and trying to lean on China. One of the things you mentioned, though, is sabotage. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about this, because you say sabotage by our country has played a role in some of the missile launch failures over time. Can you talk a little bit more about our attempts to sabotage the failures and how effective they seem to have been? Because it seems they've been fairly effective.
Well, we think they have been. Clearly, the failure rate of North Korea's missile tests in the last few years has been much, much higher than you would expect from a normal testing program. And, you know, the United States did make it known that there were cyber sabotage efforts being directed toward North Korea, I think just in part to address the growing concern in this country that the United States wasn't doing anything to try and stop them. So I think the consensus seems to be that the sabotage efforts, whether they're computers or whether it's a more conventional method of sabotaging, say, parts in the supply chain for these missiles, have been effective. Although everyone who thinks about this or who is familiar with efforts of this kind says that it's temporary at best, that you know, North Korea will figure out how to overcome it in time. And so the best we can hope is that it's just going to slow them down.
Yeah. That does seem to be one of the themes of the piece, that this is just a matter of time. And as one expert put it, this is a done deal in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at it, I mean, the United States policy 20 years ago was, we're not going to allow North Korea to explode a nuclear bomb, which they did when George W. Bush was president. And they did four more times when President Obama was in office. So, you know, all the efforts that have been made have failed to slow North Korea's sort of relentless progress toward building this weapon. And the pinnacle of that effort is going to be the ICBM with a nuke on top. And precisely because that increases their reach to the United States mainland.
Does North Korea plan to use nuclear weapons in the same way other world powers would use them? You know, mostly as a deterrent, also as a bargaining tool. I mean, do they think about them in the same ways?
I would hope they do, because the use of a nuclear weapon by North Korea would almost certainly result in their destruction. I'm convinced that the United States would respond in kind. And obviously the United States is far more capable mm-hmm. of leveling North Korea than North Korea is of leveling the United States. So really, to me, the most hopeful thing, and it's a pretty dark story, that the most hopeful part of this is that even if Kim Jong-un succeeds and builds his nuclear-tipped ICBM, using it would be an act of suicide. So
yeah.
You have to hope that the only reason he wants it is to deter this invasion, which they, you know, preach is coming any day.
You talk about dark. I want to mention Jeffrey Lewis. He's an arms control expert. He's one of the people that you interviewed for the piece. Or at least you quote him from, there's a piece that he wrote in Foreign Policy.
Right.
Yeah. Where he said that the country's leaders believe if they can inflict mass casualties in the early days of a conflict, that they can get the U.S. to rethink an invasion. They can turn back an invasion. So it's got to be what? Really brutal and ugly and bloody and horrible in the early days. That's part of a strategy.
It is, because I think they realize that a concerted American-South Korean effort would rapidly defeat their military and wipe out their infrastructure and their capability to inflict damage. So for their deterrent to be successful, they have to be able to inflict mass casualties literally within the first hours of any outbreak of conflict. And they do have that capability already.
How is South Korea thinking about all of this? Because one of the things you talk about is that, and you know, how much of a threat, like just if you think about just conventional artillery, how much of a threat are they to South Korea?
An enormous threat. There are an estimated 8,000 artillery batteries in just across the demilitarized zone, which is only about 50 miles from Seoul. One of the retired admirals that I talked to who has studied this said that if you were to lay a grid over Seoul with each block representing, say, a square of concrete on a sidewalk, that they could put a shell in every one of those blocks in the city of Seoul, which is a city of 26 million people. And that's just conventional weapons. If they loaded those shells with chemical or biological weapons, you would be talking about millions of deaths within the first few hours or days.
That's Mark Bowden. He's a national correspondent at The Atlantic magazine. His article is the cover story on the July-August issue of The Atlantic. He also has a new book out. It's called Hue 1968. It's about the Battle of Hue during the Tet Offensive in the Vietnam War. He joined us from his home in a suburb of Philadelphia. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the nuclear ambitions of North Korea. The writer Mark Bowden is joining us to take us through the different options for the U.S. A massive military strike, a limited strike, assassinate the dictator, or don't do much of anything. Bowden says none of these options, by the way, are any good, but they're all we've got. I mean, I wanted to break some of these down, if that's okay. Let's start with what seems the most frightening and most compelling option. That is this idea of prevention. Give us a sense of what prevention is, and then we'll really work through it and break it down.
Well, prevention is the idea that the United States, which is such a lopsided power compared to North Korea, could rapidly defeat North Korea and destroy its ability to launch missiles or batter Seoul with their artillery batteries. And it rests upon the hope that the United States could act with such surprise and so violently that they could shut North Korea down before it could respond.
It seems like a compelling option in some ways. I mean, the U.S. could totally pull this off. But give us a sense of how involved would something like this be for the U.S. military?
It would be the largest military action the United States has undertaken probably since World War II, because it would be, I think, in a way even larger than our investment in the Korean War. It would also involve putting forces in position stealthily, because we, even though we have roughly 50,000 troops in that region, we would need to position aircraft carriers, submarines, all the sort of infrastructure, warfighting infrastructure that the country needs to do its thing. You know, it would be war on a scale that very few Americans could recall.
We'd lose American lives, for sure.
For sure. I mean, there are 30,000 American troops who are based in South Korea. In any all-out conflict, you know, I assume they could prevail, but it would come at a great cost.
What happens to South Korea or Japan in such a scenario? I mean, there would be a massive death, I would guess, if something like that happened.
Sure. It all depends, Doug, on what would happen in the first 24, 48 hours. But as Michelle Flournoy told me, she was the Deputy Secretary for Policy in the Defense Department during the Obama administration. You know, the United States and South Korean forces are overwhelmingly stronger. But if only one or two of the mass weapons of mass destruction that North Korea possesses were to hit a target, the number of casualties would be in the millions. It would literally be one of the greatest tragedies in all of human history. And there is no way that the United States can, with any certainty, shut down 100% of North Korea's capability that quickly. I think it would take, well, the most conservative estimate I've seen is it would take about 30 days to completely defeat North Korea.
If you just did the math, do you think this, just on a sheer saving lives, the potential for lives lost in an actual ICBM missile attack, by North Korea, could it at all be worth it? And which raises the question of, would it at all be a moral political choice?
I think it would be immoral to begin this conflict. I think that, to me, the piece of the calculation that is the most scary, and if I were Korean or Japanese, this would keep me up at night, is Donald Trump's America First policy. And if you accept the logic of America First, it means that we should be first and foremost concerned with the possibility of losing Americans in a conflict with North Korea. Clearly, there are a lot of Americans based already there, but when you're talking about Los Angeles or San Francisco, you're talking about massive potential U.S. losses. And if you weigh U.S. losses more heavily than you do the Koreans who live in Seoul or the Japanese in Tokyo, you know, that's a calculation that I think is immoral, but I'm not convinced that it isn't part of the calculation that that Washington today might make.
You say it's the option that could play best with President Trump's base.
Sure, because, I mean, I remember there was a sign just down the street from where I live in Pennsylvania that said, you know, finally a candidate with balls. I mean, if the idea is that you are willing to accept mass casualties in Korea or Japan in order to get rid of North Korea once and for all. I mean, I've had callers on shows where I've talked about this article, in fact, every show, who have called in to say, why don't we just do this? So, you know, I don't think that it would be an unpopular move with a certain segment of the population. And, you know, I think that's a segment that tends to support Trump and his way of being.
But you raised the issue that even if the U.S. could, like, this is practically impossible in some ways, but even if the U.S. could pull this off with no collateral damage or very little, if the South Koreans would get on board, which is a big question, and we can get back to that, mm-hmm. whether and if the Russians and the Chinese, for example, just looked on and let the U.S. go ahead with that, you say you'd still be left, and this was really interesting, with a massive, massive humanitarian aid crisis to deal with.
You would. I mean, you would have a destroyed North Korea with no government, many, many people either irradiated or poisoned, refugees flowing over the border into China and south into South Korea, and somebody would have to take charge of this situation. I think it's very clear that it would have to be the United States. And I would imagine the people I've talked to about this project a generation or two of having to rule, essentially occupy North Korea. And if you think that the problems that the United States had trying to occupy Iraq for the years after we took out Saddam Hussein were insurmountable, try and imagine what it would be like to move into North Korea and occupy that place for 20, 40 years.
How long do you figure it would take before bands of armed fighters would start taking charge and there would be just anarchy and chaos?
Sure. I mean, this is a country that has been fed propaganda for generations and has been anticipating an American invasion. So if suddenly the Americans showed up having destroyed their government, you can count on factions in various parts of North Korea, a very mountainous country. It would be very difficult to control all of that landscape. And you can also imagine that there are stores of toxic weapons, even nuclear weapons, that might still be in the hands of people throughout the country. So it wouldn't be pretty, even if it was 100% successful.
Let's go to the next one in the also not so good policies. You say none of them are really good options. But the second one you mention is called turning the screws. Explain what this option looks like.
It's the kind of option that looks really good on paper. You theoretically begin by responding to some hostile act by North Korea by, say, wiping out one of their nuclear test sites or taking out some of their missile launch locations, a very limited strike that would nevertheless hurt North Korea and put it on notice that if they continue to behave belligerently, unless they back away from this nuclear program, they're going to continue to be hit harder and harder and harder. And the theory there is that at some point it would be in Kim's best interests to back down, to announce that they were not going to continue building a nuclear-tipped ICBM. And I think that, you know, that approach, first of all, depends on North Korea recognizing what we intend. You know, we can wipe out a nuclear site or hit a number of their missile sites, and to us, we know it's a limited action. But whether they interpret it as a limited action, there's no guarantee. They may well immediately respond as if they were being invaded. And also, you know, it leads to a tit for tat. If we hit, they hit us back. And eventually that escalation, it seems likely to me, would lead to the kind of all-out conflict that we hope to avoid.
It's so risky. You mentioned that it's kind of a delicate balance going on. I mean, you have to make it look like you mean it. But if it looks like you're trying to, you know, decimate the military, they're going to get desperate and bring everything. If you don't go far enough, it looks like you're not all that serious. I mean,
right.
It's just a really delicate balance you have to strike on that one.
And it's a delicate balance with just enormous stakes on either side. So it's one of the things that makes that a very undesirable option.
Yeah. And it raises the another matter you write about. It's this pattern, it seems like, for North Korea, what one expert called this provocation cycle.
Right.
Explain that.
Well, in the past, you know, North Korea has sort of played the United States and South Korea by doing something very belligerent, like sinking their warship, the Cheonan, which mm-hmm. killed about 79 sailors. And then, you know, when they've sort of fired up American and South Koreans to do something in response, they will offer an olive branch. They'll offer to resume talks on nuclear disarmament, or they'll make some gesture that gives a hope to negotiators that there might be some progress that can be made in the area of diplomacy. And generally what they've succeeded in doing is in getting concessions from the United States and South Korea.
Let's move to another policy option, decapitation. Explain how this works.
Well, I call that one the Hollywood option, you know. send in the SEAL Team 6, you know, to take out Kim Jong-un. And, you know, that's theoretically a legitimate tactic in that this is a very, you know, this is a state that's ruled by one person, essentially, and maybe a few people around him. And it does seem to make sense that if you could eliminate him, that you might disarm the entire state. It would be terribly difficult, number one, because clearly he would be closely protected. And I think it would definitely require someone in his inner circle turning on him, which is a very, very dangerous thing for anyone in North Korea to do. So it would be probably suicidal to send a hit team in there to try and do that. And it'd be very difficult to target him with a missile unless you knew exactly where he was. But then again, I mean, even if you were successful, who's going to replace him? Yeah. I mean, you might get somebody worse. Or you might, by targeting their supreme leader, trigger the exact response that you hope to avoid.
What kind of intelligence is there? You would think there has to be some level of discontent, obviously. You mentioned the defections on the border in China. Do we know what level of discontent might be? Because it seems like something like this would have to happen from within, or could potentially happen from within, even though it's incredibly risky. Do we know how discontented North Koreans might be? Is there any way of knowing that?
Well, there's no way of knowing it, but logic tells you that a lot of people would be very happy to see the Kim regime go. But, you know, in addition to, you know, the decades and decades of propaganda, North Korea has one of the largest political prisoner systems in the world. It's basically a gulag state. So anyone in Kim's inner circle who is the least bit skeptical or critical is either executed or sent away. People in the general population who dare speak against the regime or voice any opposition to it are quickly disposed of. So it is a very strict totalitarian system. And so in that kind of a system, I'm sure there's a lot of people who are angry and who have reason to be opposed to the state, but it's also, you know, at tremendous risk that you even speak out.
Could we do it legally? Go in and send as implausible as it might sound, send a SEAL team to kill Kim Jong-un?
Sure. You know, there's the only thing that prevents the American forces from taking out the leader of another country is a presidential order, which was signed by Ronald Reagan. But presidential orders can be superseded by a new presidential order. So, you know, President Trump could authorize something like this and in the nation's best interest and as an important act for national security, and he would have the authority to do that.
You mentioned that the South Koreans have thought about this, you know, decapitation, and that they, and I wanted to get a little bit more on this. You said that they rehearsed a kind of an option like that with the U.S. military.
Well, that's what they've reported in the South Korean press. And it seems like plausible that they would be planning or gaming out, you know, this as a possibility. But South Korea, as you know, just went through a change in government. There's a new president in South Korea, President Moon, who mm-hmm. is more disposed to trying to reopen negotiations with North Korea. He's just the other day proposed that the North Koreans and South Koreans send a unified team to the Olympic Games. He is much more of the sort of let's talk to them, let's see if we can't work this out mold. So, and there have been, you know, very large protests in South Korea against the deployment of missiles that are designed to shoot down potentially, you know, North Korean offensive missiles. So the South Koreans are not very, at the moment, I think, eager to adopt a real confrontational posture with North Korea. In fact, they seem reluctant to even take steps to more adequately defend themselves.
What impact is China having on North Korea these days? On one hand, you say it's, in some ways, it's really the best hope to, from keeping North Korea from becoming this operational nuclear power. But what is the relationship? How do you describe it these days, China and North Korea?
It's a very frosty relationship at the moment. China has made efforts to curb North Korea's nuclear ambitions. They've applied economic sanctions. You know, they have in the past, because they were ostensibly two communist regimes in that part of the world, sort of staring down Japan, South Korea, the United States, and the Western capitalism. But really, those terms hardly seem to apply anymore. I mean, North Korea is not a communist state. It's more akin to an 18th century European monarchy than a communist state. So I don't really think there's any real ideological affinity between China and North Korea. But I do think, as I said, that China, which has the capability to really hurt North Korea, it could shut off coal shipments and oil supplies to North Korea. It could cripple its economy. And it's chosen not to do so. And I think in large part because this would worsen an already bad refugee crisis on the Chinese border. China already struggles with many thousands of North Koreans who flee the Kim regime into China. And also, as I said, I think there's enough of an adversarial posture between the United States, Japan, South Korea, Vietnam even, that having this wild card in Pyongyang is not necessarily a bad thing.
It's Mark Bowden. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. His article is the cover story on the July-August issue. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Mark Bowden. We're talking about his article, which is the cover story in the latest issue of The Atlantic magazine. It's called The Worst Problem on Earth. All right, let's move to the final policy option that you work through in your piece. This is called acceptance. Explain what this is, because you'd say this would probably be the hardest pill to swallow.
This is the very thing that Trump has said will not happen. We just accept the fact that North Korea is eventually going to build this ICBM with a nuke and will theoretically be able to hit targets in the United States. I don't see, to be honest, any real alternative to this. I don't believe that we're going to be able to stop them. And I take some heart in the fact that even when they own that capability, they would be suicidal to use it. And Kim does not seem to be a crazy person or a suicidal person. And also, I think that we've lived through nuclear stalemate in the past and emerged whole from it. I mean, I described the standoff with North Korea. The old Cold War adage was mutually assured destruction, MAD. Yeah. You know, this would just be assured destruction, because they couldn't destroy the United States, but we could most certainly destroy them.
Yeah. It's interesting. This has to come from North Koreans have to be convinced, you say, that abandoning nuclear arms is in their best interest. And you write about what we need is a proper framework for disarmament. How do you convince the North Koreans that abandoning this nuclear policy is in their best interest? What would that even look like? Do you have any idea?
Well, you know, I think, ironically, one of the first steps in that direction might be them owning a nuclear-tipped ICBM, because then they might feel secure enough that the United States is not going to attack them, because they could punish us by attacking an American city. And if they feel that level of security, maybe they would be willing to start talking about opening up their economy to a very thriving Southeast Asian economy that could be a great boon to their people. You know, opening up trade, banking, these are all things that enable states to grow and prosper. We were able to negotiate a nuclear arms halt in Iran precisely because Iran does have extensive banking and trading ties with countries in Europe and in Asia. And, you know, by loosening up those sanctions as an incentive, we were able to get them to bargain away their nuclear program, at least for 15 years. I think a similar thing, it's possible, could happen in North Korea. And frankly, I think it's our best hope.
You mentioned acceptance, then this last option is going to happen, but no one's going to announce it. No one's going to come out in a State Department press conference and say we're now pursuing the policy of acceptance.
Yep. And, you know, that would be politically suicidal for an American politician to say, it's okay with me if Kim Jong-un has weapons that can hit Los Angeles. They're never going to say it, but I can't see reality shaping up in any way other than that. In order to prevent them from owning this weapon, we would have to have some means of doing that. And unless, as you mentioned, the Trump administration can come up with something that no one has been able to think of for the last 30 or 40 years, I think we're going to just be forced to accept that they're going to arrive at that point.
But what did you learn, do you think, by the American political hand-wringing over Iran? All of the concern that once they reach the point of no return, then there could potentially be all of this disaster. I mean, it became such a political issue, Iran. Do you see this potentially being the same kind of thing related to North Korea, that we can't let them reach the tipping point? We can't let them do this.
Yeah, and I think that's frankly what the piece in The Atlantic argues against. Instead of panicking at the idea that they're going to have this weapon, we ought to just get used to the idea that it's going to happen and begin to deal with it. I think it affords us, as many things, many developments around the world, there are things about it that are bad, but there are also opportunities that open up when the situation changes. So maybe, you know, when they achieve their objective here, it'll open up an opportunity to actually make some progress.
Did you ever get a sense that there could have something could have been done at some point in the history of the relationship? Too late now, but could something have been done, you know, decades ago?
It's a good question, and I hadn't really thought about it, but yes, I think so. I think the stakes would not have been as high 20 years ago or so. But nevertheless, I mean, I'm just thinking this through since I've not answered this question, but the stakes were already pretty high 20 or 30 years ago. The conventional artillery that they have zeroed in on Seoul would have meant just unconscionable levels of casualties in Seoul if the United States or South Korea had taken military action against them. So the dynamic, you know, the potential for disaster has grown over time, but the disaster itself, the potential has been there all along.
Let me ask you finally, Mark, this is something we talked about a little bit earlier in the program. You write that the threat of nuclear attack is a feature, you say, of the modern world, and that one that has grown far less existential to Americans over time. It seems like that's what you're arguing is a kind of, like it or not, a sense of realism, just to acknowledge this is the reality of geopolitics and that's just the way it is.
I think that's right. I think that, you know, it used to be when nuclear weapons were first invented that there was this terrific effort to keep the secret of how to build these bombs from other countries in the world. And of course, we see how good that was. That worked. And then the effort was to prevent smaller countries from developing their own nuclear weapons. And that has been somewhat successful, but only in a limited way. And a growing number of countries around the world have developed their own nuclear weapons. And, you know, my hope is that nuclear non-proliferation will become a global effort over time, because it just makes no sense for anyone to use a nuclear weapon. But I don't think we're anywhere near that point yet in our history.
That's Mark Bowden. He's a national correspondent with The Atlantic magazine. He also has a new book out. It's called Hue 1968. It's about the Battle of Hue during the Tet Offensive in the Vietnam War. His article is the cover story of the latest issue of The Atlantic magazine. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction today from Adrian Moranville. Our thanks also to Randy Scott Carroll. Zoe Wolf McGinn is our intern. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.